Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
Imagine spending your entire adult life meticulously building, designing, and decorating a beautiful mansion.
Right, a true masterpiece.
Exactly. You pour all your resources into the foundation. You obsess over the architecture. You tie your entire sense of self-worth and security to this structure.
You're completely invested.
Completely. And then at the very end of your life, you realize a terrifying truth. You realize you built your permanent mansion on the deck of a ferry boat.
Oh, wow.
And that boat is already, you know, halfway across the river.
That is, well, it's the fundamental cognitive error of the human condition, isn't it?
It is. Today, we are opening a 2.5 millennia-old psychological diagnostic that claims you, me, and almost everyone we know are doing exactly that right now.
We demand permanence from things that were entirely designed to be temporary.
We do. We demand it. So I want to invite you, the listener, into a very different kind of space today.
A much slower space.
Yes, exactly. Usually when we encounter information in our modern world, we consume it violently. We extract the data points. We categorize them.
Looking for the quick life hack.
Right. We look for the hack and we immediately discard the rest to move on to the next piece of content. But stepping into the world of the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, it requires a complete cessation of that transactional urgency.
It's not a transaction at all.
No. This is a contemplative transmission. It is not meant to be skimmed. It is meant to be inhabited. So let your shoulders drop. Allow the urgency of whatever you were doing before this moment to just fade into the background.
Just let it settle. We're going to move very slowly today.
We are. We're examining an ancient text not to acquire trivia, but to actively diagnose the subtle, invisible ways we generate our own suffering.
And, you know, the text we are using for this diagnostic is uniquely powerful, specifically because of its brevity and its uncompromising directness.
It really doesn't pull any punches.
It doesn't. We are exploring a canonical scripture known as the SOOTRA on the four factors.
So before we get into the exact claims this SOOTRA makes about our delusions, let's establish exactly what we are holding in our hands.
Good idea. Grounding the text is important.
Right. This is a newly available, incredibly precise, modern English translation produced by the 84,000 Project.
A truly monumental effort.
It really is. For those who aren't familiar, 84,000 is this multi-generational initiative currently translating the entirety of the Buddha's words into modern languages.
Which is an undertaking of staggering historical importance. I mean, to understand the gravity of the SOOTRA on the four factors, you have to understand where it lives.
Where it sits in the canon.
Exactly. In the Tibetan Buddhist canon, specifically in the massive collection of translated teachings called the Dije Kangyur, this text is cataloged as To 250.
To 250.
Right. But it doesn't just sit randomly in a pile of scriptures. It is part of a deeply intentional, highly organized architectural structure of wisdom.
And I want to ask about that. Why does the categorization matter to the actual practice?
It's a vital question.
Because I often see these texts grouped in numbers, right? The Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and here, a cluster of texts focused entirely on sets of four. Why the numerical obsession?
Well, look at the cognitive mechanism behind that structure. You have to remember the Buddha was teaching in a completely oral culture.
No notebooks, no recording devices.
None. But beyond mere memorization, a numbered list provides a profoundly stable cognitive framework.
What do you mean?
Well, think about the number four itself. Four legs make a chair stable, right?
Right.
Four corners secure a foundation. In the Kangyur, this SOOTRA sits alongside others, like the SOOTRA teaching the four factors, which deals with confession and clearing negative karma.
Ah, okay.
And the Noble Mahayana SOOTRA on the four factors, which focuses on the vows a practitioner must never abandon.
So they're physically grouped together in the canon.
Yes. By grouping teachings into discrete sets of four, the Buddha provided the human mind with a bounded, stable geometry.
A geometry for the mind. I love that.
It gives the anxious, wandering mind a definitive structure to rest upon while it attempts to do the, frankly, the agonizingly difficult work of untangling its own deepest delusions.
So the structure itself is a tool for the mind. That brings us to the core mission of this specific teaching.
The four specific delusions.
Right. In this text, the Buddha delivers uncompromising instructions on four very specific beliefs about happiness, security, and identity.
Things we all cling to.
He points to four things that we naturally run toward for safety, and he declares that a wise practitioner must entirely abandon the belief that any true pleasure or safety can be found there.
And we should clarify, it is not a suggestion.
No, not at all.
It is presented as an essential prerequisite for liberation. If you harbor these four beliefs, you remain trapped in the cycle of suffering.
Trapped in Samth Atra. But before we name these four beliefs, the text forces us to look at the physical ground where this realization first happened.
The setting is crucial.
I think this is a step that modern readers often skip. We want the philosophical bullet points, you know.
We want the summary.
Exactly. But the Esotra begins by vividly anchoring us in a very specific dirt, in a specific historical moment.
How does it open?
The text states, quote, "Thus did I hear at one time. The Blessed One was dwelling in Srivasti, at Jeddah Grove, in Anathapitada's park, together with a great monastic assembly of 1,250 monks," unquote.
We cannot rush past that setting. Rooting the teaching in a physical place is an essential characteristic of how the Dharma is transmitted.
It grounds it in reality.
Absolutely. This isn't a mythic story happening in the clouds between unearthly gods. Srivasti was the capital of the ancient Kerala kingdom.
It was a real bustling place.
It was chaotic, wealthy, politically complex. It was a metropolis. The Buddha intentionally situated his teachings at the very edge of this intense human activity.
And the specific location at Anathapitada's park has this incredible, almost mythical backstory that I think perfectly sets the stage for discussion about wealth, devotion, and impermanence.
Oh, the history of that park is one of the most beautiful narratives in early Buddhism.
Could you unpack that for the listener?
Sure. So Anathapitada was not his birth name. He was born Sudatta, an unimaginably wealthy merchant.
Like ancient billionaire wealthy.
Precisely. The name Anathapitada translates roughly to one who gives to the unprotected or the feeder of the orphans.
Because of his extreme philanthropy?
Yes. And when he first met the Buddha, he was so profoundly moved by the teachings that he vowed to build a sanctuary, a monastery, for the Sangha.
And to clarify for our listeners, when we use the term Sangha, we are referring to the community of Buddhist practitioners.
Correct.
In this historical moment, it specifically means the monastic community. The men and women who had entirely renounced worldly pursuits, given up all property, and dedicated their lives solely to awakening.
And they needed a place to gather.
Especially during the torrential Indian monsoons, right?
Exactly. The wandering mendicants needed a dry, safe place to undergo intense meditation retreats during the rainy season.
And so they didn't harm the explosion of insect life on the muddy roads.
Right, the principle of non-harming. So Anathapitada finds the perfect location near Srivasti, a tranquil grove owned by a royal, Prince Jaya.
Okay, so he goes to the prince.
He approaches the prince to buy it. Prince Jada, likely annoyed or perhaps wanting to test the merchant's devotion, says he will only sell the land if Anathapitada covers every single inch of the ground with gold coins.
Which was essentially a dismissive joke.
A completely absurd price.
A price so absurd no one could possibly pay it.
But Anathapitada didn't blink.
He didn't even hesitate.
He immediately ordered his carts full of gold to be brought to the grove. He began literally paving the dirt tree by tree with gold coins.
Just laying them down in the mud.
Laying them down. Prince Jada was so astonished by this staggering display of non-attachment to wealth, this absolute prioritization of spiritual truth over material accumulation, that he stopped him and donated the rest of the land himself.
It forces you to pause, doesn't it?
It really does.
Think of the modern equivalent.
Yeah.
Imagine a billionaire liquidating their entire portfolio, not to buy a media company, not to build a vanity rocket, but literally turning it into cash and laying it over a public park.
Just so people who have taken a vow of poverty have a quiet place to sit.
Right. To sit and investigate the nature of their own minds. It establishes an atmosphere of absolute devotion.
It tells the listener, what you are about to hear was purchased with an ocean of gold.
It is that valuable.
And it grounds the text in undeniable historical reality.
Yeah.
The Buddha was a real human being. He felt the intense heat of the Indian summer. He relied entirely on the extreme generosity of lay people like Anathapitada just to have a safe place to sleep.
And by anchoring the philosophy in this physical dirt, the tradition prevents the teachings from floating away into academic abstraction.
Keeps it grounded.
It sends a clear message across the centuries, you know?
Hmm.
This profound psychological awakening happened in the real world amidst the messiness of human economics and society.
Which means awakening is entirely possible for you right now in the messiness of your world.
I really feel that grounding. So we are sitting in this gold purchase park with an assembly of 1,250 silent monks.
The physical setting is established.
Now, the text transitions into how the Buddha actually spoke. We are looking at a pedagogy from an entirely oral culture.
Right.
Before books, before recordings, before any external memory storage, how do you transmit complex psychological instructions so they survive intact for millennia?
You have to utilize the biology of the human nervous system.
Explain that.
Well, the text gives us a very specific, deliberate description of the Buddha's voice. It says he spoke in a voice that was, quote, steady, deep, harmonious, and far-reaching.
That isn't just a poetic compliment from a devoted follower, is it?
Not at all.
Because there is a functional mechanism at play here. When I imagine a voice that is steady, deep, and harmonious, I immediately think of the physiological effect that has on a listener.
It is entirely functional. We know from modern neuroscience and psychology that a deep, steady, rhythmic vocal tone directly stimulates the vagus nerve in the listener.
The vagus nerve.
Yes. It downregulates the sympathetic nervous system, which is the fight or flight response, and it engages the parasympathetic nervous system, which governs rest, digestion, and receptivity.
So it calms the body down.
Physically calms it. A far-reaching voice that is simultaneously harmonious commands absolute attention without generating the slightest bit of anxiety or agitation.
The Buddha was essentially inducing a state of physiological safety.
Exactly, and profound cognitive receptivity in the audience before he even delivered the intellectual content.
He's preparing the soil before planting the seed.
Beautifully put.
And once he has their nervous systems regulated, he uses a fascinating rhetorical device. Reading the prose section of this SOTRA, you immediately notice a relentless repetition.
The anaphora.
Yes, what we call in literature anaphora, the deliberate repetition of the opening phrase of a sentence. For every single point he makes, he begins with the exact same formula.
Which is?
Quote, monks, for as long as he lives, a wise son of good family does not hold the belief that, end quote. And then he names the delusion.
And then he does it again.
Then again. Quote, monks, for as long as he lives, a wise son of good family does not hold the belief that.
Right. And consider the dual purpose of this anaphora. On a purely historical logistical level, it is the ultimate mnemonic scaffolding.
For memory.
Right. If 1,250 people need to memorize a complex psychological breakdown without a single written note, anaphora ensures that if you lose your place, the rhythm carries you back.
You know exactly how the next stanza begins.
Exactly. But there's a spiritual purpose, too.
I was going to say, sitting with the text, the repetition doesn't feel just like a memory trick.
Yeah.
It feels heavy, penetrative. When I read it aloud, the rhythm reminds me of the steady, unvarying beat of a drum in a traditional ceremony, or the rhythmic counting of the breath that you use in foundational meditation practices to settle the mind.
Yes, you are touching on the concept of Sha Mahjda.
Calm abiding.
Exactly. Which in the Buddhist tradition refers to calm abiding. It is the practice of repeatedly bringing the mind back to a single, stable point of focus, often the breath, to develop incredibly deep, unshakable concentration.
So is the repetitive structure of the SOTRI itself a form of guided Ja Mahjda?
Absolutely it is. The human intellect, particularly the default mode network of our brains, is addicted to novelty.
We always want the next new thing.
It constantly wants new data, new entertainment, a new argument to chew on. When the Buddha repeats the exact same phrase, monks, for as long as he lives, he is intentionally starving the intellect of that novelty.
Wow.
The intellectual, argumentative part of the mind gets bored by the repetition and drops its defenses.
It just gives up.
And once the armor of the intellect is bypassed, the actual substance of the teaching, the hammer blow against our delusion, can sink directly into the deeper layers of consciousness.
It wears you down in the best possible way.
It really does.
The rhythm bypasses the part of me that wants to argue. So we are grounded in the park. Our nervous systems are settled by the voice. Our intellectual defenses are bypassed by the rhythm.
Now for the actual substance.
Right. What is the hammer actually striking? The Buddha begins laying out the four false beliefs. The first two factors deal directly with the external world, where we mistakenly look outside of ourselves for our ultimate safety and pleasure.
Factor number one.
Factor number one. The Buddha states, quote, monks, for as long as he lives, A wise son of good family does not hold the belief that there is pleasure to be found in women.
Okay, let's immediately address the historical and social context of that phrasing.
Yes, we definitely need to unpack that.
Because an unexamined reading can cause a modern listener to completely miss the psychological truth being offered here.
It sounds jarring to modern ears.
It does. This language is explicitly androcentric. It is entirely male-centric. We have to remember who is sitting in the dirt listening to this.
The 1,250 monks.
Exactly. Yeah. 1,250 heterosexual male monastics who have taken strict vows of celibacy.
Right. In that specific societal context, for that specific audience, the primary object of intense physical desire, romantic attachment, and worldly entanglement would be women.
It is highly tailored, incredibly practical advice for the demographic right in front of him.
Exactly.
Precisely. If we get caught in a debate about ancient gender dynamics, we miss the universal human diagnosis.
So what is the broader diagnosis here?
What the Buddha is actually pointing a laser at is the deeply ingrained human delusion that we can find our ultimate refuge, our permanent validation, or our enduring happiness in romantic entanglement, sexual attraction, or external relationships.
It is the myth of the other half. The idea that I am incomplete, fundamentally broken or lacking, and if I can just find the perfect partner, if I can just secure their love and their physical presence, then my suffering will magically cease.
We place an impossible, crushing burden on our partners to be our saviors from our own existential dread.
It's totally unfair to them, honestly.
And that is exactly why it is a false belief. No other human being can be your ultimate refuge. Another human being is a complex, ever-changing biological organism subject to their own karmic causes and conditions.
They have their own dharma to work out.
They will change their minds. They will get sick. The relationship will experience friction. And ultimately, invariably, the relationship will end through separation or death.
It's an uncomfortable truth.
To place the entirety of your hope for permanent security on a connection with another mortal being is a fundamental mathematical error in the calculation of your own happiness.
It's setting yourself up for guaranteed devastation. The wise person loves, the wise person connects deeply, but they do not harbor the secret, desperate belief that the connection is a permanent shield against suffering.
Exactly. You can appreciate the connection without demanding it be your salvation, and that realization bridges perfectly into the second external delusion.
Okay, what's the second factor?
If we cannot find ultimate security in our intimate relationships, the mind naturally zooms out and tries to find it in the collective.
Factor two. The Buddha says, quote, "Monks, for as long as he lives, a wise son of good family does not hold the belief that there is pleasure to be found at the court of the royal palace."
The royal court.
The royal court. We're talking about proximity to power.
In ancient Kosala, the royal court was the absolute epicenter of wealth, political influence, and social status. It was the place where your relevance was determined.
Let's translate that into the modern psychological landscape. Most of us aren't hanging out with literal kings.
No, but the royal court is everywhere.
Right. It's the desperate networking on LinkedIn to be seen by the right executives. It's the obsession with the corporate ladder.
It is the agonizing pursuit of clout and algorithmic visibility on social media.
Yes. It is a belief that if I just reach a certain level of status, if the right people recognize my name, I will finally be safe.
Look at the neuroscience of why the human brain clings to status. We are tribal evolutionary primates.
We needed the tribe to survive.
Historically, if you were cast out of the tribe, if you lost your status, you died of starvation or exposure, your brain equates social status with literal biological survival.
So it's hardwired.
It is deeply hardwired. When you get a promotion or when you get a surge of likes, your brain floods with serotonin and dopamine. It feels exactly like safety.
But it's temporary.
The Buddha is asking these monks to look at this deeply hardwired biological instinct and recognize it as a complete lie.
But wait, I have to push back on this a little bit.
Please do.
I understand the danger of vanity. But if we completely abandon the royal court, if we view any pursuit of influence or societal status as a delusion, doesn't society just collapse?
That's a common concern.
Isn't there a danger of spiritual bypassing here? I mean, to change the world, to stop a corrupt king, to build hospitals, to enact justice, you often have to be in the room where the decisions are made.
Right. You need some form of power.
If all the wise people abandon the royal court because it's quote unquote unstable, they are just handing the world over to bad actors. How do we reconcile the desire to actively, compassionately engage with the world with the Buddhist stark warning to abandon the court?
That is the most important tension in modern practice, and it requires a very precise understanding of what the Buddha means by refuge.
Okay, unpack that.
The Buddha is not commanding physical isolation or political apathy. The Buddha himself walked right into the royal courts.
He did.
He constantly advised King Pasenadi of Kosala. He debated with ministers. He mediated literal military conflicts between states. He was deeply, actively engaged in the society of his time.
So he was at the court. But the Esso Tra says a wise person doesn't believe pleasure is found there.
Exactly. The key word is belief. The Buddha did not believe for a single second that his interactions with the king were the source of his own inner peace or his security. He did not derive his identity from his proximity to the throne. If King Pasenadi had turned on him and exiled him, the Buddha's internal state would not have flickered.
Because his foundation was somewhere else?
Because his foundation was not built on the king's favor.
I see. It's the difference between action and identity.
Yes. You can, and often should, participate in society with profound compassion. You can hold a position of immense corporate or political power and use it masterfully to alleviate the suffering of thousands of people.
But the attachment to the role.
But the absolute moment you start believing that your title, your corner office, or your social influence is what makes you a worthy or safe person, the moment your emotional equilibrium relies on the continued approval of the court, you are building a mansion on the deck of a ferry boat.
You are participating in the delusion.
Exactly. A wise practitioner can stand right in the center of the royal court, fully engaged, while remaining completely internally free of it.
That is a staggering level of psychological freedom.
It's the goal.
To be in the world, doing the work, but completely untethered from the outcome of your own status. Okay, so those are the first two factors, the external refuges of romantic attachment and societal power.
Now, the teaching makes a profound pivot inward.
It does. The Buddha directs our attention away from other people and points the laser at our most intimate private attachments, our own biology and our own material stockpiles.
Factor three.
The Buddha says, quote, monks, for as long as he lives, a wise son of good family does not hold the belief that he's attractive, handsome, good-looking, and in good health.
This one is physically painful to confront.
It really is.
This is the clinging to our own vitality. It is a delusion that permeates every aspect of our modern youth-obsessed culture. We spend billions of dollars on cosmetics, on supplements, on surgeries, engaging in a desperate, ultimately futile war against the reality of biological decay.
Because when we are healthy, we experience health not as a temporary weather pattern, but as a permanent personality trait.
We identify with it.
We implicitly believe I am a healthy person.
Which is a denial of the fundamental Buddhist understanding of reality. In the foundational teachings, there are four inevitable realities that every being must pass through. They're often called the four rivers of suffering.
Birth, aging, sickness, and death.
Birth, aging, sickness, and death. Your body is a biological organism. It is an amalgamation of elements that are constantly in flux. Its inherent, undeniable nature is to age. Its nature is to eventually break down.
But we view illness or aging as a betrayal.
We really do.
When my back suddenly goes out or when I see a new gray hair, my psychological reaction isn't just, oh, biology is occurring.
Right, biology is occurring.
My reaction is something has gone wrong. I'm being robbed.
And that feeling of betrayal is the exact measurement of your delusion.
Oh, that's powerful.
If you truly understood the nature of the body, you would not feel betrayed when it acts exactly like a body.
You wouldn't be surprised.
No. The Buddha is saying that relying on your current good health or your physical attractiveness as a guarantee of your ongoing happiness is a profound cognitive error.
It's a house of cards.
When we believe we are our health, the natural onset of illness becomes a catastrophic psychological crisis. The wise person exercises, they eat well, they care for the biological machine with great respect, but they do not harbor the insane belief that the machine is permanent.
Which leads directly into the final prose instruction, the illusion of material permanence.
Factor four,
quote, monks, for as long as he lives, a wise son of good family does not hold the belief that he is rich, wealthy, and has abundant resources.
Wealth is the ultimate illusion of control.
It really feels like control, though.
It does. We hoard resources because we believe a large enough bank account can act as an impenetrable moat against the unpredictable terror of the universe.
And to push back again, Wealth does solve a lot of problems.
Of course it does.
It buys medicine, it buys shelter, it buys the ability to escape bad situations.
Hmm?
It is very hard to tell someone struggling to pay rent that wealth is a delusion.
And the Buddha is not denying the relative utility of resources. Again, look at the patron of this gathering, Anathapiyata. His wealth built the very park they're sitting in.
Right. It literally facilitated the Dharma.
The utility of wealth is undeniable. What is being diagnosed here is the belief that wealth provides ultimate enduring pleasure or safety.
Because it can disappear.
Wealth is ephemeral. It can be wiped out by market crashes, stolen, or destroyed by natural disaster. But more profoundly, even if you manage to fiercely protect your wealth for your entire life, it is rendered entirely agonizingly meaningless at the moment of your death.
You can't take it with you.
You cannot bribe the dissolution of your own consciousness. If your entire identity is built on being a wealthy person, you will suffer immensely when the reality of impermanence inevitably strips those resources from you.
This brings us back to the analogy of the house on the crumbling cliff. You can enjoy the warmth of the fire in the house. You can appreciate the view. But the suffering begins the exact moment you convince yourself that the cliff is not actively eroding beneath your feet.
That is the perfect encapsulation of the prose teachings. But what elevates this esoötra from a brilliant psychological treatise into a profound work of spiritual art is what happens next.
The shift in tone.
After methodically deconstructing these four refuges using that rhythmic anaphora, the Buddha completely shifts his pedagogical approach.
He moves from prose to poetry.
He synthesizes the entire dense intellectual argument into striking unforgettable poetic metaphors. He bypasses the intellect entirely and strikes the heart.
I want to read these concluding verses exactly as they are translated. It is just breathtaking literature.
Please do.
The Buddha says, quote, "How could it be right to depend on women? How could the royal palace ever be delightful? How could a bubble possess a solid core? How could one's wealth possibly endure? Wealth is like a rushing river. A home is like a ferry boat. One's body resembles a flower. Life itself is like a water bubble."
He takes all the complex logic we just spent time unpacking and turns it into immediate, visceral reality.
Let's look deeply at these four images, starting with the first. Wealth is like a rushing river.
A river is raw kinetic energy. It is constant, unstoppable movement.
Which perfectly describes economics. Resources, money, value. They're inherently fluid.
They flow toward you, they pool around you briefly, and they flow away from you. They change form.
What happens if you walk into a rushing river and try to grab a handful of water and hold it still?
The water violently escapes, it slips right through your fingers, and you just end up exhausted fighting the current.
You exhaust your one precious human life trying to freeze a river.
Yes. A wise practitioner learns how to navigate the river. They learn how to build a water wheel to utilize the energy of the stream as it passes to help others.
But they do not stand in the freezing rapids, desperately trying to grip the water, believing they can hold it forever. The next metaphor hit me the hardest. A home is like a ferry boat. It completely recontextualizes our relationship to our environment and our status.
Think about the fundamental nature of a ferry boat. What is its purpose?
It is a vehicle of transition. You get on it specifically to go somewhere else. It carries you from one shore across dangerous waters to the other shore.
It is absolutely necessary for the crossing. But you do not mistake the ferry boat for the destination.
You don't lay down roots on a ferry.
You do not drag your family heirlooms onto the deck, lay down a foundation, build a roof, and refuse to disembark when the boat finally reaches the other side.
That would be absurd.
Our homes, our careers, our physical situations in life, they are temporary vessels carrying our consciousness through time. To cling to a specific home or a specific state of living as an absolute permanent reality is a tragic misunderstanding of what a vessel is built for.
One's body resembles a flower. We touched on this with factor three, but seeing it reduced to the image of a flower makes it so poignant.
A flower is undeniably beautiful. It blooms in its specific season. It attracts life. It offers fragrance.
There is nothing wrong with appreciating the beauty of the flower.
But woven into the very DNA, into the absolute definition of a flower, is the fact that it must wilt and return to the soil.
It's part of the design.
The wilting is not a failure of the flower. It is the successful completion of its cycle. If you demand that the flower remain in full bloom forever, you are demanding an aggressive impossibility.
And you suffer for it.
And more tragically, you will spend the flower's entire brief lifespan living in a state of paralyzing anxiety, meticulously watching for the first brown petal to appear.
You miss the beauty entirely because you are terrified of the inevitable decay.
Exactly.
And then the ultimate sweeping summation of impermanence. Life itself is like a water bubble. Earlier in the verse, the Buddha asks the rhetorical question, how could a bubble possess a solid core?
With this single image, the Buddha introduces the deepest, most radical teaching of the Dharma, the concept of emptiness, or shunyata.
Explain emptiness in this context, because the word empty usually implies a void or a lack of meaning, which sounds very nihilistic.
Emptiness in the Buddhist sense is the exact opposite of nihilism. It means empty of inherent, independent, permanent existence.
Okay, so how does that relate to the bubble?
Look at a water bubble floating in the air. Does the bubble exist? Yes, you can see it. It is beautiful. It reflects the sunlight in iridescent colors. It is a real phenomenon that you can experience.
But it doesn't have a solid core. It has no actual substance inside.
Precisely. It is a temporary manifestation entirely dependent on causes and conditions, a specific combination of water, soap, surface tension, and air pressure.
And if one of those changes?
The moment one of those conditions changes, the bubble pops, leaving absolutely no trace behind. It was real, but it was not solid.
And that applies to us.
The Buddha is stating that our entire reality, our ego, our identity, our life itself, functions exactly like that bubble. We exist, we experience joy and pain, we reflect the light, but we lack a permanent, unchanging, solid core. When we frantically search for absolute permanent security inside a fragile bubble, we are guaranteeing our own psychological torture.
It is incredible how these four brief metaphors contain the entirety of the path. And historically, we know these specific poetic verses were not just confined to this one gathering.
No, they're widespread.
The translators note that these exact metaphors also appear in another canonical text, the Shilesa Yukta Sutra, which is cataloged as To 303.
That cross-pollination is a vital detail. It demonstrates that these metaphors were recognized by the early masters as perfect, crystalline expressions of truth.
They became a shared language.
They became part of a shared vocabulary awakening, echoing across different texts, lineages, and centuries, because human psychology doesn't change.
A monk in ancient India and a commuter in a modern city suffer from the exact same delusion of the bubble.
Exactly the same.
That universality brings us to the conclusion of the text, which details the immediate reaction to this teaching. And the text reveals that it wasn't just the 1,250 monks who were listening.
The audience was much larger.
The Esotra states, quote, when the Blessed One had said this, the monks, together with the world of devas, humans, asuras, and gandharvas, rejoiced and praised the words of the Blessed One.
We need to explore this cosmic audience.
We do, because it dramatically expands the scope of what we're discussing. Who are these beings?
In classical Buddhist cosmology, the physical realm of humans is just one narrow band on a vast spectrum of existence. The text explicitly names devas, asuras, and gandharvas.
Let's break those down. Devas first.
Devas are understood as heavenly beings or gods inhabiting realms of unimaginable, prolonged sensory pleasure and luxury.
And asuras.
Asuras are often translated as titans or demigods, and their defining psychological characteristic is intense jealousy, competitiveness, and a constant warlike striving for dominance.
And the gandharvas.
Gandharvas are subtle, celestial musicians, beings who feed on beautiful scents and sounds.
Even if a modern listener views these realms purely as psychological archetypes rather than literal dimensions, their inclusion here is fascinating. Why mention them?
Because it emphasizes that the truth of impermanence is the absolute law of the universe, regardless of your status.
It applies to everyone.
Even a deva, a god, living a lifespan of millions of years in a palace of pure light, is still caught in the trap. Their heavenly existence is still ultimately a water bubble. It will eventually pop.
Their palace is just a very, very luxurious ferry boat.
Exactly. The suffering that arises from relying on the ephemeral applies universally across all states of consciousness. So when the Buddha articulates this truth with such crystalline clarity, all beings who have the karmic capacity to understand it, whether they are human monks in the dirt or jealous titans or blissful gods, they all rejoice.
Because the truth, however stark, is the only thing that actually liberates the mind from fear.
Yes.
And this text has been liberating minds for a very long time. The history of how these words survived to reach our ears today is a testament to the devotion it inspired.
The lineage of preservation is remarkable. Within the Tibetan tradition, the Stock Palace edition of the Kangyur includes a specific concluding note that categorizes this SOOTRA within the teachings of the first turning of the wheel of Dharma.
What does the first turning signify?
In the Tibetan classification of the Buddhist teachings, the first turning represents the foundational core instructions delivered immediately after his enlightenment.
The basics.
It focuses heavily on the Four Noble Truths, the mechanics of karma, and the undeniable reality of impermanence. This is the tradition of the Shravakas, the early hearers or disciples.
The translators of the 84,000 Project specifically note that this text lacks any uniquely Mahayana viewpoints.
Right.
It doesn't explicitly discuss the Bodhisattva path, the vow to save all sentient beings, or the more complex philosophical elaborations on emptiness found in later texts.
Which is exactly why it is so powerful. It doesn't need those elaborations. It is the absolute bedrock.
You have to start here.
Whether you are a practitioner of the Tara Vyechda tradition in Southeast Asia, the Mahayana tradition in East Asia, or the Vajrayana tradition in Tibet, if you have not internalized the message of these four factors, your entire spiritual practice is built on a fantasy.
Because you're still secretly clinging.
You cannot build a profound spiritual structure if you still secretly believe that a new relationship or promotion will finally make you happy.
And the early Tibetan masters recognized this foundational importance immediately.
They absolutely did. During the massive state-sponsored effort by the Tibetan Empire in the 8th and 9th centuries to translate the entire Buddhist canon from Sanskrit into Tibetan, this text was highly prioritized.
It was right at the top of the list.
While we don't have the specific colophon telling us the exact name of the translator, we know its antiquity because it is explicitly listed in the two oldest imperial catalogs of translated works, the Dhenkarma and the Fengthangma.
And it was also specifically summarized by Kawa Poltsek, who is one of the most brilliant and prolific translators of the early Tibetan propagation of the Dharma.
The fact that a master like Kawa Poltsek singled it out shows that the greatest minds in the tradition looked at this brief, repetitive text and saw a complete, flawless diagnostic manual for the human ego.
They saw its utility.
They preserved it meticulously so that it could eventually cross the ocean, be translated into English, and be discussed by us today.
Which brings us to the present moment. We have spent this time walking through the physical dirt of Anathapita's park. We've felt the rhythmic strike of the Buddha's anaphora. We've analyzed the futility of seeking permanent refuge in relationships, status, youth, and wealth.
And we've envisioned the rushing river and the fragile bubble.
As we prepare to close this period of contemplation, we need to synthesize this ancient wisdom into a practical tool for the modern listener.
How to actually use it.
Right. The central thesis is undeniable. The deepest, most agonizing suffering in our lives does not come from the world itself. It comes directly from our demand that the temporary world act as if it were permanent.
It is the exhausting, impossible project of trying to solidify a universe that is fundamentally fluid.
So how does the listener apply this SOTRA to their actual life when they wake up tomorrow morning and have to go to work or deal with a failing relationship or face a medical diagnosis?
You take these four factors and you use them as a surgical diagnostic tool.
A diagnostic tool.
When you find yourself experiencing a spike in anxiety or a wave of dread or a deep gnawing dissatisfaction with your life, you stop. You don't try to fix the external situation immediately.
What do you do instead?
Instead, you use the SOOTRA to investigate your own mind. You ask yourself honestly, where am I placing my refuge right now?
You look for the delusion.
Exactly. You ask, am I currently expecting a water bubble to have a solid core? Am I looking at my bank account or my job title or my partner and demanding that they provide an absolute permanent security that they are biologically and physically incapable of providing?
Am I furiously trying to build a permanent mansion on a ferry boat?
Exactly. That's the question.
That diagnostic approach completely shifts the paradigm of our pain. It means the anxiety isn't a sign that your life is fundamentally broken or that you have failed.
No, not at all.
The anxiety is simply an alarm bell indicating that your view is wrong. You are expecting the impossible. The pain is the friction between reality and your delusion.
And recognizing that delusion is the first necessary and most profound step toward actual liberation from it. You cannot untangle a knot until you see exactly how it is tied.
I want to leave you, the listener, with a final contemplation that builds on the poetry of this text.
It's important to close on this note.
It is very easy to listen to a teaching on impermanence, to hear about the rushing river, the wilting flower, the ferry boat, and feel a heavy sense of loss. To feel that if everything is fleeting, if the bubble must pop, then life is just a tragedy of things slipping away through our fingers.
That's a common but mistaken reaction.
But I urge you to look deeper at what the Buddha is actually offering here. It is not nihilism. It is an invitation to lay down an impossible burden.
A heavy burden we don't need to carry.
If wealth is truly a river, if the physical body is inevitably a flower, and a home is merely a ferry boat, then the truest, deepest form of freedom isn't found in desperately trying to freeze the river.
No.
It isn't found in trying to chemically alter the flower to stop it from wilting. True freedom is found in the profound, radical relaxation that washes over you when you finally let the ferry boat do exactly what it was built to do.
Which is to carry you across the waters of transition.
Completely unburdened by the demand that it'll last forever.
That relaxation is the cessation of striving. It is the beginning of genuine, unshakable peace.
We began this teaching by acknowledging the transactional urgency of our modern world. We want things to be fixed, binary, and permanent. We want the world to hold still.
But it won't.
But the Esso Tra on the four factors offers us a mirror to see that our suffering comes from that very demand. It shows us that the muddy waters of our minds clear only when we stop thrashing around, trying to find a solid rock to hold onto in the middle of the rapids.
And instead, learn to simply observe the miraculous temporary flow of the stream.
May these teachings take deep root in your practice, and may they help you to finally recognize the bubble for what it is.
Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from BodhiArchive.org.